After the Tournament of Champions came to an end, the Tucson Aerobatic Shootout became one of the most important RC aerobatic competitions in the world, with the best pilots gathering to compete in IMAC and freestyle. Today, I'm talking to Brian Mack, two-time invitational champion as well as multiple freestyle podium finisher. In our chat, we do a deep dive on precision aerobatics and IMAC, and Brian talks about his journey to the top of the aerobatic scene. He shares his process on setting up and adjusting a competition-winning IMAC airplane, and gives us a glimpse on his training mindset. Hey, Brian. How are you doing,
good,
man?
How are you
good
doing?
To see you. Thank you for joining us in the Skybound RC podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I think a lot of people probably know you from either seeing some like killer kind of demo freestyle videos of you online, or they actually know you from IMAC competitions because you've been having like really, really good results in the past couple of years. But maybe you can give a bit of a background about how you got started in RC and aerobatics for those that don't know you very well.
Okay, yeah. When I was, my dad in like the late 80s, early 90s was in the RC and was flying pattern. And then, so I'm the third child. My parents had three kids. So he started having kids, having family, kind of got out of it. The time I was about 8 or 9 years old, he taught me how to fly just like a four channel trainer, you know. And then from there, I mean, I was always going out to the field with him as a kid, even before I flew. So he taught me how to fly. And then a couple years later, I like really wanted to like keep flying. I was getting more into it. So he started teaching me like some like basic, you know, 4 points and like that kind of simple pattern type maneuvers. And then when I was about, I think when I was 11, I flew my first IMAC contest. I had a 72-inch Giles 202 with like a OS 160. I went and flew basic, and I think I got third. but
nice.
That pretty much started it all. I didn't do much for the rest of that year, but the next year, which was 2010, I started flying more of like the local competitions. Still with I had a Glow Extra, like 70-something-inch Extra. And I flew the first couple contests of that year, and then we bought a 35% AeroWorks 260. So that was like my first big gas airplane. And I flew Sportsman that year, and I was doing really well. I won the region, and I went to Clover Creek, flew Sportsman at Clover Creek, and ended up winning. And then I actually flew that AeroWorks 35% all the way up through Advance for like the next couple years. And then, after that, I flew the shootout with it in 2011. I think I got third in Advanced, and I flew freestyle with the same airplane. So we were like switching props between rounds and like pulling the spinner off. It had like a really heavy, like, I don't even know if it was a true turn, but, yeah, so.
Like a big aluminum. Yeah.
Yeah. And then after that, I was gifted actually a Cardin, 118-inch Cardin from a good friend of ours, Steve Nelson. I flew that for about 2 years. Awesome airplane. And then my dad actually built the Dalton that I've been flying. We finished it in 2015, and I flew it in Unlimited at the shootout. And that's actually what I've flown since it's been finished. So 2015 to 2022.
Wow.
It's had a lot of flights on it, a couple of different setups through it, and it means a lot to me. It's like a really nostalgic, you know, there's a lot to it. It's more than just an airplane for me. So we've kind of been talking about maybe retiring it because it's the best airplane I've ever flown. Like, it's literally perfect, but I don't want to see it like something fail and have it crash. I kind of want to keep it around. So we actually got one of the
has a lot of history already.
Yeah, for sure. So I think I'm not quite sure yet what I'll be flying this year, but I have one of the new Cardins from JR, so I'll be putting that together and trying it out.
So you mentioned pattern. Your dad was flying pattern when you were a kid, or before having kids. And then you jumped into IMAC. For those people that might not be very familiar with, robotic competitions, pattern, IMAC, can you talk a bit about, you know, what pattern is, and especially what IMAC is?
Yeah, so they're kind of similar in terms of you're flying a, there's, you know, they all have different classes for different difficulties, but you're flying a set of maneuvers that everyone has, and you all get judged on how well you can complete the maneuvers with how precise and everything, you know, the angles, the geometry. IMAX, really, it's modeled after the IAC, so like full-scale aerobatic competitions. So patterns gotten a bit crazy where like the planes have, the designs have gotten really intense, and it's really focused on making them like perfect for what they're trying to do. Or IMAX kind of moved in the direction, you know, like TOC, where it's more scale airplanes, more like the real aerobatic planes, but pretty similar in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so with both of them, you have these like sequences that you are given, right? You practice and you have to perform this set of like 10, 12 maneuvers as precise as possible, right? And then you are judged based on that precision. And yeah, I think what you said, like pattern seems to be a bit more towards, you don't have the limitation of following the full scale planes, both in the design of the plane and in terms of the maneuvers. I think, like, I know that pattern lately, they've been doing a lot of like crazy, a lot of knife edge based maneuvers that a full scale plane you wouldn't see, right? So, so you don't have that so much in IMAX. And then the IMAX is like, usually larger planes. I don't know what the max size of IMAX is, but usually you would see like a 115-inch or 120-inch at most, right?
Yeah, that's pretty common.
And I think the other thing I've seen, at least in my experience, that in most IMAX competitions, you have also not only the known sequence, but you also have the unknown, right?
At like your typical, like a local IMAX contest, it's usually Saturday, Sunday. And it usually consists of, on Saturday, you'll fly two known rounds, which is at the beginning of the year, they release, say it's like advanced class. They release the advanced sequence. Everyone has them. That's what you practice all year. So everyone knows that. So you'll fly the known round, two rounds on Saturday, typically. And then Saturday night, they'll give all the pilots the unknown sequence. And you're not allowed to practice on a simulator. You know, you're not allowed to go fly. That's the whole point of it, is you're supposed to use the stick plane and visualize what the sequence is going to look like as you fly it. But the whole challenge of it is that you don't get to practice it. So your caller is pretty important when it comes to the unknown, because you have to trust they're going to call the right thing. You know, especially once you get into the higher classes, it gets tricky to where you have directional rolls and snaps, and say sometimes you'll have a maneuver that you have to, like a Humpty bump, where you're going to go up and you either have to take it out or in, but depending the directions and everything of the rolls and snaps, it's going to change where you end up on your positioning and all that. So it can get pretty complicated, but so typically you would fly an unknown sequence Sunday morning and then finish the contest with one more known round at the end. But it could get hairy for some people. It's pretty interesting, but for me, the unknown aspect of it is what I really enjoyed flying IMAC, where I'm pretty sure FAI pattern has unknowns also, but that's like the very, very top of the top.
Yeah, I think my understanding is that most classes in pattern, you don't have the unknown. I think in certain classes you do, in certain specific competitions, like I think like maybe nationals, and of course the world championship thing on the finals they have. But yeah, I think that the typical pattern pilot doesn't deal as much with unknown sequences as the typical IMAC pilot. So I think that's probably one of the big differences. And yeah, I think in my experience many years ago when I was competing in IMAC, I think, yeah, the unknown is very interesting, because you can have the top 5 pilots or 10 pilots kind of flying very, very good known sequences. Everybody has the chance to practice this for weeks or even months. And then you come to the unknowns, and it's where differences between pilots show up very clearly, right? Any minor mistake brings you way down on the scores, and having that like experience with your plane and understanding how it's going to respond with this type of snap in this type of flying condition, it's going to make all of the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I've noticed over the years is you can have a really close contest, like you said, between all of the top five or whatever it is, and it usually comes down to the unknowns. So, I mean, everyone can be flying the knowns really, really well, but if you mess up one or two maneuvers, especially at like the higher level, it that usually is the determining factor. You'll, like in an invitational class, you fly five rounds of your knowns and five rounds of your unknowns. So it's pretty critical there that you need to like nail all your unknowns or you're not, like, you have no chance basically.
And the suit-out, are those five different unknown programs?
Yeah, so, and what's interesting in the invitational class is we don't actually get them till the morning. So, like, at the pilot's meeting that morning, they'll hand you your unknown, and you have 2 hours to study it or whatever it ends up being.
Oh, yeah, that's challenging, especially because those, yeah, at that level, the sequences are pretty hardcore complicated. They're pretty hard to memorize, pretty hard to fly, pretty hard to even call as the caller.
Yeah, I hate calling. I can't do it. I like it
sounds difficult.
My words
sounds difficult
up.
And stressful.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want to do as a caller is like ruin somebody's flight and competition because you made a mistake, not even being the pilot, right?
Totally.
Yeah. So we're talking about the Tucson suit-out. Can you talk a bit about what's so significant about the suit-out? Like, you know, there's a lot of IMAC competitions in the US and in the world, but I think the suit-out is a bit special. Can you talk a bit about it? I think you have a lot of experience in that competition.
Yeah, so I'm sure most people that are going to be watching this know of the TOC and like what the TOC was. So after that kind of finished, the shootout was sort of like the next big international competition where they're drawing pilots from sort of all over the world. And you also had Clover Creek, but that's another story. But yeah, the shootout for me is like the last like big, you know, historical kind of IMAX style event in the US where you get people from all over the world. And it's pretty special. It's definitely special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember seeing, you know, like the right after the TOC, all those TOC pilots or some of the best TOC pilots, like, you know, Simonzini, Tip Hyde, Sulman, Paisan Leroux, like, they were coming all over the world from, like, specifically to compete in the suit-out, right? So I think that kind of became, like, the biggest, you know, large-scale aerobatic competition in RC. And it seems like you've been doing pretty well. Like, how many times have you participated in the suit-out?
I think five or six now, and I've flown four of those in invitational.
And I believe you got first place in invitational in the past at least 2 years, right?
Yeah, 2019.
The past two editions of the suit-out.
Yeah, for me, like as I was like getting into IMAC and the freestyle stuff, that was like I'd be on YouTube, you know, watching like Tucson shootout videos or whatever, you know. Like freestyle, mm-hmm. All of the guys, like you're saying, all the big names that were flying, like those guys were kind of like who I like idolized as I was learning all this stuff. So it's definitely like a historic competition as far as IMAC goes, giant scale aerobatics.
How do you go about preparing for one of these competitions, specifically the suit-out? You know, do you have, I think if you go to some small competition, you can probably pull from your experience and good skills and put out a good flight and good results on something as high level as a Tucson Aerobatic Suit-Out in Invitational. I think that preparation has to be a very big part of it, right? Of having a successful contest. How did you go about training for this kind of competition, both in the, you know, known, unknown?
So usually after they release the knowns, I'll go out and just start flying the known sequences, get familiar with them, kind of figure out, you know, whatever, like the biggest thing for me is the positioning of maneuvers. Like if you get kind of cramped and rushed, you end up having a really bad flight because you imagine you're trying to fit, especially at the invitational level, you have so many elements, you know, between rolls, snaps, all this stuff on like a downline or whatever it may be. You really have to get the pace down to where you're not rushing yourself. You can fly through it smoothly. And that can be fairly difficult at that high level of invitational because there's just so much going on. So I usually get back into the swing of things, practicing the knowns, get familiar with them, and then I have like a stockpile of all these knowns and unknowns from previous years. So what me and my dad, who always calls for me, will start doing is just, he'll grab like a couple, two random sequences, and then I'll go up and fly, not knowing what sequence he's going to be calling, and just try to call strictly from what I'm hearing from him. And, that's kind of a strategy that's helped me improve on the unknowns a lot. But it's still tricky because you have to, some people get in a really comfortable of like, always snapping a certain way or doing things in a certain way. And sometimes that catches you off guard because you'll have a maneuver with a snap or a set of like point rolls or something in kind of a different position than you're normally used to doing them. So it's good sometimes even to just maybe make up some of your own maneuvers that are a bit crazy, but it'll give you a better idea of how the airplane might react in a different situation.
Yeah, it feels like you have to be comfortable and experienced doing a bit of everything, right? So that when an unknown comes to you in a contest, you're just putting together things that you've done before. You don't have to do a lot of experimentation. And still, it's impossible, right? You cannot cover every single thing in advance. What are the typical areas where people struggle the most? I'm imagining that snap rolls tend to be pretty tricky, right? Because they, like, dealing with that, the timing and the inertia and make sure you stop it on the spot. It's tricky in general, and especially when you are doing things with different directions or different positions, not the same if it's on an upline or a 45-degree downline, like the type of things make a big difference, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So like even just going from like a upline snap to a downline snap, like depending on the plane a little bit, but usually the speed of it is going to be different. Maybe how it stops, how the snap actually stops on like an upline might be a little more mushy versus like when you have more airspeed, it's going to go boom, just stop. But other things too, like you'll have maybe say like a down loop and they'll give you like a 3 of 4 and then opposite like -1.25 snap or something. Well, you have to carry enough speed to make the loop nice and smooth, but that's going to make your snap like really aggressive. So that's more what I mean about different positions, like you said, or like a 45 downline. Typically, the airplane wants to fly really slow if you don't add throttle and like force it through the line. So there's different techniques. People probably have different opinions on these kind of things, but a lot of it's just knowing exactly how your airplane's going to react in most situations.
Mm-hmm. In terms of presentation, I know, you know, again, this was 15 years ago when I was doing IMAC. I know that different pilots had different flying styles, and even different judges had different kind of preferences of what they like to see. Like some people like to see the plane a bit closer to you in terms of distance, in terms of altitude. Other pilots might like to put a bit more distance so that they have kind of bigger maneuvers. You have a bit more time to think in between maneuvers or to get ready, especially in unknowns, that could be handy. Are things like pretty standardized today, or do you still see those type of like style differences and that type of like almost a strategy when thinking about how to put out a flight in a competition?
Yeah, there's definitely still differences in style, you know, and between pilots flying and the judges, but the judging criteria is pretty nailed down to where it doesn't really matter what kind of style you fly or the judge's preference. It's more of if you fly it well enough and they can't see anything wrong, it doesn't matter how big or how slow you roll or whatever it may be. You kind of don't give them a chance to even be able to downgrade you, right? And you'll see it between pilots, you know, like some guys like to do like a really fast, hard looking point roll versus some of the like the pattern flyers like Shulman and these other guys are really smooth and they'll take up like a long stall turn downline or something doing most of their point roll versus some guys will center it really well but do like a quick choppy roll. But I really think it always evens out. So they, like at the shootout, for example, they rotate judges. So every round that you fly is a different group of judges. So even if maybe you get nailed by a judge that doesn't exactly like your flying style one round, the next round, it's not going to be the same. So it really evens out.
Let's talk about iMac airplanes. So when I go to pretty much any field, at least here in Northern California, I often see the same three or four brands of airplanes. So you see the Pilot RCs, the Extreme Flight, Skywing, SunCarve. However, when you look at the planes that people use in iMac, especially at the higher classes, you know, like Unlimited or Invitational in a shootout, I think that the brands tend to be fairly different when looking at airframes. I think you see the Cardens, the Daltons, old school. You see some of the Cam Arrows. So what's the main difference between the typical, I guess, freestyle demo type airframe and the typical good iMac airframe?
Yeah, I like to think of it that a lot of these ARFs are kind of built with in mind that you could sort of fly them in any style that you want. So, and they've gotten a lot better over the years. Like the ARFs that are coming out now versus when I first started are like insanely good. You can put like a 120cc Skywing together and go fly iMac and do well because they are good airplanes. But the difference between, you know, like an ARF, Extreme Flight, Skywing, CARF, any of these, and like a kit-built Camaro or a Dalton or a Carden, is that the kit-built planes have kind of been tailor-made to fly iMac. Like, they're kind of more of a purpose-built iMac airplane. Like, the Dalton, for example, is stretched. The fuse is longer. It kind of is more, like, pattern-esque. It's designed for iMac, where you can get away with flying an ARF, but it's never going to be quite as good. Is kind of why you're seeing that. There is people that have done well and successfully fly, you know, some of the more common ARFs or other brands, but typically to be competitive at a very high level, you sort of need one of these kit-built airplanes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like usually you see them being a bit like, yeah, what they are saying, a bit longer fuselage, right? Surfaces tend to be smaller because you are not aiming to do like any like 3D or extreme aerobatic type things. So I think you can probably get a bit more precision there. What about size? I think nowadays the 100-120cc airplane is like probably the most popular one in aerobatics. But when you get into iMac, I think you tend to favor more larger airframes, right?
Yeah, so typically like a 3-meter-ish, you know, 120-ish inch wingspan around there. It's kind of like a formula. Like, everyone's gone to basically a DA-200, most of them on like canisters, you know, kit-built airplane around that 40% size, just because people that have flown like a 120cc size plane versus a 40% can understand this. I'm sure that even just that little size difference, a lot of the flight characteristics change a lot. So the planes fly with a lot less wing loading. Not to say that like the smaller ones fly heavy, so to say. It's just that it's different, and they have a lot more like airspeed braking, drag-ish, if you could say, on like a downline or something, versus the smaller planes usually tend to fly faster. There's a lot of aerodynamic differences, and it doesn't really transfer over. Like, you could do well with that smaller size, but it's just something about that larger size plane just works a little bit better, flies better for iMac.
So the airplane you've been using on the past couple of years, can you talk a bit about what your setup, what equipment you're using in there, and the why behind it?
Yeah, so I have it's a Dalton ML. I've used a DA-200, 3014 prop. We have JTEC QC-120 canisters and linear haul JR servos, you know, JR X-Bus receivers. that's pretty much what I've been running for years. And that airplane, it hasn't changed a whole lot since 2018-ish.
So you're using the four-cylinder DA200 there, right?
Yeah,
it seems like the DA200 is like a pretty popular choice in like unlimited invitational iMac, right? It seems like people really like that.
Yeah, it's a really smooth engine. So like iMac, you're typically flying a lot, practicing a lot, and they're long flights. Like you're going to be flying probably 12 minutes for most guys in the like higher end classes. It takes a while. So you see, like, it's the power advantage of the DA200. It makes the most power realistically out of anything out there, really. And it's also, it's smooth. It's easier on your servo gear train and all that, because when you're flying so much, like you're wearing the servos and stuff out a lot, especially if you have like a DA170, for example, vibrates quite a bit and it makes similar power, almost as much power, but it, the kind of wear and tear on the airframe and your electronics is harder. So I think that's why you see the 200 so often. Is it's a really good engine and it makes very linear power, like no matter what exhaust setup you have on it. So you can throttle up nice and smooth. There's no weird transition. It's like very linear.
Yeah. So, at this high level in these competitions, of course, the equipment you're using is like pretty critical. I think when you have like a lot of pilots with really, really good skills, any small advantage you can get because of the airframe, because of the engine, because of the propeller you choose can make a big difference. I imagine that the setup is the other part that also can make a huge difference at this level, right? Can you talk a bit about how you go about kind of setting up your plane in terms of throws, in terms of trimming, in terms of any mixes you might be using, in terms of center of gravity? Like if you're putting a new iMac plane together for the next shootout, where everything has to be as perfect as possible, how do you approach that process?
Yeah, okay. So it's a pretty long process too. Like starting off, like I typically would just made an airplane, get everything like roughly where I think the throws might need to be, the CG, you know, that sort of thing, and then fly it a little bit, maybe move the CG back or forward a touch, see how it feels. And it's more of like a process of trial and error. So yeah, I'll set up like for mixing a knife edge coupling, pitch if it needs it a little bit, downline mix so that when you're on the downline with no throttle, the airplane isn't trying to pull out, you know, holds a straight line. That's usually maybe a 2 or 3% elevator mix on no throttle. And it really does. Sometimes it can take a while because you have to fly the airplane quite a bit to realize it's kind of doing this thing that I'm not quite sure what it is just yet, but I know something's not quite right. And then after you fly maybe 2 weeks, you'll go in and change elevator rate in your snaps or something like that. You know, it tends to take a while to trim an airplane out really well. But on the same hand, sometimes you get really lucky, like the Dalton I'm flying now. When we first set it up, we honestly haven't changed much with the CG at all. Like anything as far as moving components around in the plane, nothing's really changed. We kind of just got lucky and it was almost perfect. It does depend on the airplane, but a lot of it is going out and flying it enough to get the feel and realizing what maybe you're not totally vibing with.
Okay, so in terms of mixing, yeah, so it sounds like you probably use the, you know, rudder to elevator, rudder to ailerons to make sure that you have minimal coupling, right? I guess that you try to do that at whatever throttle setting and speed is at which you usually do like things like slow rolls and rolling circles and things like that.
I usually start for like knife edge mixing. I'll start at a pretty high speed, but not like ripping, you know, not like full throttle, like maybe 3/4-ish throttle, get it really close. And then that's usually a good base for like all around speeds. You know, once you get really slow, like high alpha with the 3D plane, mixing's kind of like out the window. But yeah, so I'll typically do that first, and then the downline mix will be the next thing. But all of this kind of depends on CG too. So every time you make a small change, it might throw some of these other things off. So that's why I'm saying it's a it could be a long process because you can kind of be working in one direction and decide you're going to change things a little bit, and then it kind of throws everything off. So it's a mm-hmm. process, and it the next thing I would go from, like, if I'm initially setting up an airplane, would be getting the elevators tied in perfectly together. Like, it doesn't always mean that they're going to be perfectly level with each other. Like, to get a nice smooth corner and the plane's not coming to the side like this, you know,
mm-hmm.
not every plane is perfect. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to need the elevators to be perfectly centered with each other. Sometimes one may need to be up just a touch, or the thrust line could also cause some of that. If you have too much right thrust, the plane's always going to be trying to hunt to the right. So you're going to trim rudder into it, and that can cause it to maybe try and drop a wing as you're pulling into a corner. So
mm-hmm. do you use any kind of mixes for those type of, like, you know, full throttle, upline? Do you use any kind of, like, mix on rudder to make sure that tracking straight on the upline, or do you just rely purely on the kind of angle of the engine?
Yeah, I know some people do. I've never done that. I've always tried to mechanically get the thrust, like, as perfect as we could. So there's a few different ways to do that, but obviously, like, trimming the plane out, going straight away from you, and then seeing how it reacts in an upline at full throttle. That's a good way to set your right mm-hmm. thrust. And also, like, down thrust can affect a lot of things. If you have too much down thrust, you're going to have a lot of up elevator trim in the airplane. So another test we like to do is, like, pretty high speed flying flat level across the field and just cut the throttle. And the plane should slowly drop off, right? It shouldn't hang there or go up. Mm-hmm. So those kind of things can help you determine where your thrust line's at and maybe where you should try and make some changes, but it gets complicated. It's hard to know sometimes what's causing what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every time you change something, especially the CG, but everything kind of affects everything else, right? So
yeah.
You cannot just look at one single factor in isolation. And that's what makes it, like, very, very long process.
Yeah. And, funny thing is, like, when I was younger as a kid, I would always be like, no, it's good. My dad's like, no, we need to change this. We need to try this. And I'd be like, no, it's fine. Don't mess with it. And then he'd do it. And I'd be like, oh, that feels better. He's like, yeah. So, and that'd be
it's,
like,
it's not a very fun process.
No, you know, you kind of get used to the way you have a plane set up, and maybe it's pretty good, and you just settle with that. Yeah. And a lot of people do, but it could almost always be better if you just make those small little details do make a difference, especially at, like, invitational yeah. at the shootout. You know, like you said, you're trying to use everything you can to your advantage. So the better your airplane flies and is set up, the easier it is for you. Like, if you're flying an unknown, the last thing you want to be worried about is, oh, every time I do, you know, a roller, the plane is rolling faster when I'm on right rudder versus left, or, you know, this kind of thing. You don't, yep. you don't want to be thinking about that. You want to just be able to fly the plane. So the better you can make the airplane fly, the more you can focus on the maneuver you're flying.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I've been pretty lazy, doing any of this stuff with my planes, because, you know, I'm just doing, like, fun freestyle demo flight type things. I know I stood, like, spend a day just doing some basic, like, rudder to aileron, rudder to elevator mixes, so that, you know, when I'm doing, like, a one roll in a circle, you know, there's nothing, like, kind of modifying the roll or the pitch of the airplane. But I'm not in a competition. I'm not, like, competing against, like, 10 extremely skilled pilots. It's not in the world. But yeah, when you are aiming for that, like, first spot in a shootout, you need to have everything 100% dialed in.
Yep. Yeah, and I'm kind of the same way. Like, with my freestyle stuff, I'll get it close, but I usually don't spend, like, a massive amount of time. You know, I get the CG where I want it, the throws and everything, and that's pretty much good.
How did you go about flight modes, dual rates, things like that for iMac? Do you have different flight modes for different dual rates, depending on what you're doing? Do you have, do you keep everything the same through the flight? How do you approach that?
For quite a, like, many years now, I've used flight modes. So I'll have one three position switch set up with like a typical normal flying rate for most everything. Mm-hmm. And then I'll have a snap rate, and then I'll have like a high rate for like stall turns and spins. So the normal flying would be most everything through the maneuvers, roll elements, but I tend to fly a lot on my snap rate, which is feels similar, but it's going to have more aileron, more setup for snaps, obviously. But I try to make those two mm-hmm. modes feel almost the same around center for like most, you know, radiuses and rolls and stuff. Cause you also don't want to, at least in my opinion, I don't want to be worried about flipping switches constantly while I'm trying to fly through complicated yep. maneuvers. So if I'm going into like a roller or something, I'll just be on my normal rate. I have enough rudder and everything in that to do IMAX style rollers. And then typically going into any maneuver with a snap, I'll pretty much just have it on my snap rate ready to go. It has enough rate to do everything plus my snap roll preference, you know. And then I have my high rate for stalls, stall turns, that kind of thing, tail slides. So typically I'll like a stall turn, for example, I'll go into that on my snap rate, whatever roll elements, snaps, and then I'll flip the high rate, do my hammerhead, and then back to snap rate. My setup's pretty simple. I know some guys have like a lot of different things that they're constantly flipping through, but I try to keep it pretty simple.
Yeah, the snap rolls in particular seem to just make everything so much harder because, yeah, like you're doing what you were talking about before. You have any snap element in the middle of a loop, for example, and you cannot be switching, or you don't want to be switching midway in a loop, right? Because you have like some elevator applied. You might even be correcting with some aileron or some rudder if there's wind. And all of a sudden you switch modes that probably would be visible to the jets that something changed, right? Mm-hmm. But you need to have that additional throw for the snap element. I wonder, this is something I haven't tried, but I've always thought that could be interesting, is having relatively low throws, like, you know, what you are talking about here as your low throws, your regular flight, and then have some kind of condition where if you bring the stick to the last 10% of travel, right, like that, you know, you're almost at the end, you have like a completely different throw. So not quite exponential curve, but you know, you have your exponential, and at the end just like makes a big jump. I know that different radios will behave differently in terms of programming this, but I think that could be something interesting. So you have kind of the benefit of both sides. Yeah. You're always on like low rates for full precision. And when you go to the extreme is when you completely override.
A lot of people have started doing that probably for the last 4 or 5 years. It seems maybe a little bit longer. In IMAC, they've basically they don't have any flight mode set up. They have stick conditions. So mm-hmm. say
yep.
they have their normal feeling rate, like my normal flight mode. And then whenever they get to the point they have a snap, they can set, you know, I have to see 90% elevator or more, 90% aileron or more, and 90% rudder or more, and it'll engage the snap rate. So they can just bury the sticks to the corners, their snap rate comes on, mm-hmm. everything's good. And I've flown a couple people's airplanes set up that way, and I know it works for them, doesn't work for me. Everyone has different techniques and all that, but I don't necessarily snap by just going to the corners, especially depending on like the attitude of the plane, like the position of where the snap is. You don't always want to use like full rudder and full elevator, like an upline snap. You're trying to maintain as much energy as you can, even though like with mm-hmm. the DA200 and all that, like you're still, especially if it's windy, it's going to make it tough for power. So if you have like a double mm-hmm. negative snap.
Yeah, the snap roll can like completely slow down the plane.
Yeah, so you're trying to, it just depends for me. So I'm sure that works for some people. I've tried it and I didn't really like it, but it's all just preference.
Yeah, it makes sense. I also think that even if potentially it could work, it's something that would probably take a good amount of time to get used to. To get used to it, it's not like a very straightforward kind of thing in terms of the feel you get on the sticks. So you're talking about the snap rolls, and I think that's again, it's one of the usually most challenging maneuvers, one of the things that people sometimes do incorrectly and completely breaks their flight and their score goes way down. So I'm kind of curious to see or to hear how you think about those snap rolls, how you approach them. I remember many, many years ago, I was on one of the main IMAC competitions in Europe, basically the equivalent to the Unlimited nowadays. And me and everybody else had their pretty clear style on how to do snap rolls. And then Gernot Brugman came with a very different style. I think back then, most of us were kind of using aileron, rudder, elevator more or less simultaneously. And then Gernot came with a very clear, crisp brake on elevator first. So you could clearly see how the nose would go up and then it would do the actual rotation. And it was interesting because you could see on the Thursday, the practice day, how everybody was like trying to emulate that. Mm. And people slowly change their snap style within the course of a day, which is probably not a very good idea, but we were all looking at the top pilot back then. How did you try, like, what's your general process for snaps? I know that different, you know, it's not the same if it's a single roll versus a 1.5 versus an upline or downline, but what's your general approach to snap rolls?
So generally pretty similar, especially with the plane I've been flying, the Dalton. It does much better if you like aggressively break the nose before you snap.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, you don't have to do it like crazy, right? Like it's almost one motion. Like as that's happening, you're starting the snap. But for me, I try to do that like accentuated even more, especially at the shootout, because they're kind of looking for that. The rules state that the nose break can be simultaneous, but it's better to try to like really,
you want
to
make it obvious.
Yeah, you want to kind of overdo it to not even chance getting zeroed on it, right? But it really does mm-hmm. make most airplanes snap better. And it's not so much that you're stalling it out. It's just depending on what, like the line you're on too, like a downline snap, typically the plane's going to try to fall from your 45 down by the time you're through the snap. So by breaking the nose like mm-hmm. that, you're sort of giving yourself a better chance to stay on the line. And
So you kind of break the line with elevator and then you bring it back with rather and a bit of the elevator through the through the turn.
Yeah, and especially for like upline snaps as well, is the plane isn't really going to try and fly straight after the snap. So I've noticed it kind of helps keep the plane online for whatever reason. Like you're breaking, you're sort of stalling it, but you're like that initial nose break kind of helps the auto rotation stay more straight. So it's, guys like Gernot, Mark Leesburg, they kind of like were the ones that started doing that. And I guess I see why mm-hmm. for me it works. That's kind of how I approach mine.
How do you go about the stopping the snap roll, the kind of making sure that you are neutralizing things and the plane doesn't ever rotate and you nail that exit every time?
Yeah, it's tough. I don't really have any like special technique. Like I'm just watching the plane and reacting to it. A lot of times you'll see guys will maybe under rotate a snap a bit. Like say you have like a 1.5, when they finish more like 1.25 and then they like roll out of it. They try to like hide it. That's like a clear zero at an IMAC competition, but sometimes it happens, but there's no really like good way to try to exit it. Like you're pretty much just, I've found that a faster rate helps with these things too. Like you just have to find what you're comfortable with and just like repetitively practice that. And you will start to get a feel for what the airplane's going to do in different attitudes and about, your timing from where you need to stop to end level or on knife edge, whatever you're aiming for. You just have to develop that feel. And it's different with every plane.
Yeah. Do you feel like you tend to, I think with, especially with ailerons on the exit, I've seen two major approaches. I think probably the most common one is to neutralize elevator rather a little bit earlier than aileron, and then neutralize aileron slightly early accounting for the bit of inertia the plane will have, right? So you, with a lot of practice, you know that, you know, maybe like 1/8 of a roll before your desired position, then you do the neutral ailerons and the plane will give you that extra, let's say, 1/8 roll rotation. I think that's probably the most common one I've seen. And then, yeah, you might try to like hide a little bit if it wasn't perfect. The other thing I've seen less, but I've also seen, is actually taking the plane all the way to the desired exit position and then kind of do a bit of counter aileron to basically try to stop suddenly the rotation, like avoid the inertia, right? Interestingly, I think one of the guys that does this best from what I've seen has been Dusia, like in a non-IMAC context, obviously, like just doing it in demo flights and freestyle. And I think he's practiced that enough that he's able to do it pretty well.
Yeah.
But I don't know how common that is in an IMAC competition.
So I used to do that kind of, this is like 10 years ago, like before the servo technologies gotten to where it is now, they were slower, less strong. I had developed that same thing, and it was basically because the servos weren't fast enough. So you get to a point where you get comfortable, like, bam, just a little bit of opposite aileron, and you can stop it super crisp, like same as you're saying Jace is doing. But I feel like I've kind of gone away from that on the IMAX stuff because the servos have gotten so good that they're so fast, you almost don't need to. Now, sometimes, like with freestyle planes, I'll do it still, and it's just because of more like the setup and just how that smaller size plane flies. But you'll see it from time to time, and it's a good skill to have because if you over rotate a little bit and you're quick on the stick and you could bang back, maybe they won't catch that, you know, 5-10 degree little change you made right at the end of the snap. So it definitely still happens, but I think it's a little bit less common to see that.
When you look at a pilot that is kind of progressing between, let's say, I believe it's advanced, unlimited, and then some competitions like the Surat will have the invitational, what are the main, like, are you able to more or less like point what are the main differences in skill? Maybe it's mindset, maybe it's like the color skills in the unknowns. Like, what are kind of those differences that you see between an advanced versus unlimited versus an invitational pilot?
So advanced is the first class where you get introduced to partial snaps. So you can have anywhere from a half snap to two full snaps, so 1.5, 1.75, you know, 3/4 snap, those kind of things. So going from intermediate to advanced, that's probably the biggest jump. You have partial snaps now that you're dealing with, a little bit more complex maneuvers with point rolls, opposite snaps, and then you have a three-roll roller typically. And then going up from advanced to unlimited, it's kind of the same idea. You have just a little bit more complex figures, a little bit harder, a little bit just more in-depth elements, whereas advanced is almost as hard, but that jump to unlimited is just taking it just up to the next level a little bit. And then going from unlimited to invitational is a very big jump. It is a very big jump. It gets a lot more complicated and there's just so much more going on. Like I was talking about earlier, it's really easy to get rushed and run out of room. Like we're doing like a snap and a half opposite 8-point roll on a downline or something. So the height that you're having to fly all the figures is like way higher. Like you have to fly much bigger, a little bit farther out to even be able to get through the maneuver without it just looking terrible because you run out of space.
Yeah, I can imagine at that level for the unknowns, you not only need a really good experienced caller, but also you need to come with a pretty good strategy on your head already of where to position things, how much space to give yourself in certain maneuvers, because yeah, you might get into a situation where even if you're doing everything precisely, everything that your caller is telling you, if you don't give you enough room, in certain positions, you might be having to exit early, or you have to put the plane way out there on the right side, where the judges cannot even see the plane very well anymore, and because you then position things to account for that.
That's what I always have a hard time going from, like, I don't go and fly iMac like all the time anymore. So like on a shootout year, like I'm going to start practicing pretty much like right now at this time, you know, February, March. And those are some of the things that I struggle with a lot. Like when they release the nodes and I go out and start flying them for the first time, I'm like, you know, at the end of the box, I'm pointing the plane in at me a little bit. Like I'm not used to seeing the wings perfect. I'm positioning in too close. I'm not flying big enough. So I'm getting rushed. And it just takes some time. Like that's part of the practice, is getting back used to, you know, I need to position the plane way, way out here, like over the trees at this spot on my field. That's ideal. That's where I like to fly. That's where I feel the best. So you really have to get comfortable with whatever works best for you. You know, people have different preferences, but like you were saying, a lot of it's in the preparation before you even get to the shootout. Like if you're already there, like you need to have it in your head, like a strategy for.
One thing that to me is really impressive with you and just a few other pilots is something you just touched on, and it's that I've seen, you know, there's like amazing pattern pilots out there, and that's all they do. That's all they do, and they're really good at it. And you know, they probably have the skills and they have the experience and the training behind it. Then there's the same goes with IMAC. I think there's some pilots that they are totally focused on the IMAC precision aerobatic side of things, right? The known and unknown. And then there's other pilots like Lucia or maybe Anthony D'Souza. I think that they are very focused on the freestyle, and they're amazing freestyle pilots. I think one interesting thing about you is that you have been very successful and you're really good with both the pure IMAC side of things, rather the known and unknown sequences that we are talking about. But you've also been really good with freestyle, and I think that's part of it is challenging, just because you cannot be training for both at the same time, right? You are splitting your time between both. But even more, at least in my mind, makes it even harder is that you are doing both at the same time in a competition like this without, right? Like it's not that you are going to do a pattern or a IMAC known and unknown competition in March, and then you go to September and you do a freestyle only competition, and you can like kind of focus on one or the other. I think in the Tucson Surat, you are doing a bit of both back and forth, right? With different planes, different setup.
Yeah, like back
completely
to back.
Different flying style. Yeah, that to me is very, very challenging. Like I know in the past when I was doing this and it wasn't at this high level, that was challenging. If you have the same plane, you have completely different setup. If you have different planes, which at this level, I think most people are using different planes, the feel is totally different. The type of visual cues that you have, it's totally different. Like it's two completely different things to go back and forth, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes down to, like, if you fly an airplane enough, it doesn't matter if you go fly a foamy or something. As soon as you come back to that one, your iMac plane, you're going to go, oh, yeah, I know this thing like the back of my hand. Like, it doesn't matter. So there's some of that element, but it still is tough. Like Friday, Saturday, Sunday at the shootout, you're flying an invitational unknown, and then you're going and flying freestyle, and then you're flying an invitational known, and then you're going and flying freestyle. So it gets chaotic as far as the time frame. Like you don't have a lot of time in between, as well as you're switching between different airplanes, different feeling stuff. But for me, I've always felt that IMAC has made me a better freestyle pilot, and that freestyle has also made me a better IMAC pilot. As far as the precision side of the IMAC stuff, if you're doing like a maneuver and you're like hitting every point, you're square with the field, you know, you have like nice looking angles on it, it's always going to look better versus if you're not, right? And the freestyle is, with all the rolling, you know, stuff and tumbles and all that, I feel like that's kind of helped with IMAC as far as snaps, like going each direction and left or right, and, you know, positive, negative. It doesn't really matter to me so much anymore because I'm so used to just doing whatever, going back and forth, rolling both directions, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Versus some people get kind of stuck in their ways of, I always want to snap this way, or I always want to roll this way, or you don't really have that choice anymore once you get to a high level of iMac. So mm-hmm. I feel like it's important for you to do both, at least in some aspect. You know, even if you don't compete in iMac, it's not a bad idea for you to just go out and try flying the sequence a little bit. And if you have someone at your field that does, just be like, hey, give me some pointers on like what I could do better with this and this. And that's going to make it, mm-hmm. that's going to make anyone a better pilot, you know? So that's always kind of been my take on it.
100% agree. I'm one of those people that definitely prefers, enjoys more both watching and flying freestyle rather than iMac. But I 100% agree that having at least some experience, some practice, it could be experience in competition, ideally, but it also could even be just you at home, just trying to fly a good iMac routine. It's huge in terms of making you a better pilot, even for freestyle. I think, especially nowadays, it's very common to see some pilots that can be pretty good at certain freestyle maneuvers in isolation, but you can tell that they don't have the full control of the plane at all times. They don't like make the plane go in the direction they want. They don't make things parallel to the runway or perpendicular to the runway. Things are just the way they come out each time, and each time is different. When you see good freestyle, that is not only aggressive, but it's also precise in the entries, in the exits, in the direction, in the positioning. I feel like it's very common to see that better in pilots that have some amount of like iMac or pattern experience, because their brains, like, that's the way it works now with robotics, right? That things have to be on the right position with the right orientation and with maximum precision. It's not just being as aggressive as possible.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, I'm kind of like you, where I've always enjoyed the freestyle stuff. Like, that's always what's like really excited me about like giant scale aerobatics. But I'd be out practicing as a kid, and I get like halfway through a sequence and mess something up and be like, ah, and then I just like start flying freestyle, like get some of that frustration out. And then I'd be like, good. And like, all right, let's mm-hmm. start over, go back into it. And like, I feel like it's good to have a balance between both. Even if you're not interested in the iMac, it is good to do some precision flying.
Yeah. No, it definitely makes you a better pilot, and it's extremely challenging. So right now the shootout is still the top, probably the biggest iMac competition in the world, probably, definitely in the US. Do you wish that there was more competitions that are combining both? Like, we've had, you know, the TOC originally was a single competition where freestyle is part of it. I think it was probably the smallest part in the score, but it still was an important part of the competition. I believe a few years ago there was the Invitational.
Yeah.
I think it wasn't where they do the Clover Creek. Where also I believe that one was everything combined. Mm-hmm. Which makes makes people that only want to do iMac have to deal with freestyle, and makes only freestyle pilots also have to deal with iMac. So ultimately you end up with the most complete aerobatic pilot, in my opinion. Do you wish there was more of that rather than kind of separate competitions?
It would be interesting, because not only does it create kind of a different dynamic as far as the competition goes, it would get some of the, like Jace, some of these guys that typically only fly like freestyle stuff, it would be cool to get more like integration, you know? So everyone, mm-hmm. maybe the rules are you have to fly one airplane for both. So, you know, you'd see different kind of setups from the typical 120cc, like super aggressive style, mm-hmm. or I think it would be cool to see some of that in the future, because it would just create something a little bit different.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be interesting. It's tricky, because I know that some pilots, you know, some pure iMac pilots would not want to do that because they haven't been doing freestyle in many years, and they don't want to like suddenly go to the bottom of the scores, because that's not what they do. And the other way around, right? Like somebody like Jace Ducia, who's like one of the top freestyle pilots. I'm sure he could do very well in iMac if he wanted to.
For sure.
But that requires now a lot of training on something that he might not be interested in doing. So I know that some pilots would maybe not see it with the best eyes, but it would be really interesting to to get us to, yeah, I think it makes me think of the TOC. It's that, that's like the probably the hardest competition to win, right? You have to be really, really good, if not the best at both. If I just said you have the same airframe, that also brings new challenges in terms of what's the best plane, what's the best setup, because now if you are trying to do crazy fast rifle rolls, for example, or you want like extreme deflections in elevator, that might affect negatively to your like IMAC sequences, right? So it'll be something pretty different, pretty interesting, I think.
Yeah, it might bring some innovation too. You know, people, I've heard the idea and seen it tossed around over the years since I was first getting into this, but like an aircraft where you can change the CG like on a tray that's powered by a servo or something, you know, like something like that. Like, who knows? Like, maybe you see some crazy like inventions that people are making just for that one competition. It could be cool.
Yeah, I mean, that one would be tricky in IMAC mainly because of the whole idea of like trying to follow the full scale. I would imagine that would be one of those things that they don't want to do because it like starts to deviate. I think for something like similar to the pattern side, where I think people have a bit more freedom in terms of the airframes, that could be interesting.
Even if it didn't end up, even if it's not like IMAC specific, I think it would be cool to see like, yeah, maybe more like FIA, F3A style maneuvers, like knife edge loops on like a 45 angled out, you know, something crazy for like a sequence that you have to fly, but it's like a freestyle sequence more than like an IMAX sequence, maybe. That kind of thing could be cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't even remember the name. I remember many, many years ago when I was just getting started in aerobatics back in like, I don't know, 2006 or 2007. I remember there was it was an actual category international that was similar airframes as F3A, but for freestyle. It was like an aeromusical 4 minute. I think they even had like a known sequence, which means that they give you the music and then you have like an pure freestyle where you put the music. I think I haven't seen that in like many, many years. I guess that didn't work. I think it might have been called like F6A, maybe. I guess that didn't like work out. I think one of the challenges too is that I don't think there's very many people doing freestyle. I think freestyle tends to be very intimidating because it's risky for the plane. And you usually see like the top 10 pilots in the world doing crazy things. And everything that is not that doesn't feel as good, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I think I've even seen that in like small IMAC competitions, right? There's not a lot of participation in freestyle. So I think it's always challenging to do a lot, to push the sport a lot on that side of things.
Yeah, it's tough. So like when I first got into IMAC, it would be like me and Spencer Nordquist, Kim Quinette, Matt Stringer, like these, we were all, you know, Santiago, we'd be flying freestyle, but over the years, it kind of seemed like that died off a little bit, but last year and this year, it seems that at least in like the Southwest region, they've been incorporating freestyle back into the IMAC contest, like to try to draw some of like the newer people. And to me, it seems like IMAC sort of chilled out a little bit, like not a ton of new people are coming into it, but it seems like a lot of people getting into the hobby are like very interested in freestyle. Like they're going and buying a 60-inch extreme flight or something and learning 3D, and then they're moving up to 100cc, 40%, whatever, eventually. But it would be cool to find a way to get more people that are excited by that involved in like something like IMAC too. So maybe some of those competitions might help with that. I'm not sure. But
yeah. Switching gears a little bit, I think you recently went to Japan, right? With a couple of the JR guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
how was that?
Dude, it's awesome. Japan's amazing. They they do an air show there every year. So it's usually like the first week of November. So I went 2019, my first time, and it was just me that went over there. And it was just incredible, like blew my mind. They had a PAU extra like set up exactly how I would do it at home, like all ready to go. And it was awesome, man. And then this last year and 2022, we've had like eight JR pilots go. So it's like me, Tim Hanstein, Timmy, you know, a bunch of people all going and just having a good time. And they put on this amazing air show where there's everything from Zeros doing like a World War II demonstration, like formation flight, to turbine powered gliders, to car fly babies, to 120cc extras, like doing crazy freestyle jets. Like, it's really pretty cool to watch. And they get an amazing spectator turnout to where they get thousands and thousands of spectators come out because they do it on a national holiday there. So like the first year I went, there was like 34,000 spectators or something. Insane.
Wow. That's crazy.
Like, super nervous. I don't ever get nervous. I'm like shaking up there. Like I hit the elevator on the ground.
Yeah, it's pretty different from like not even a Surat has that. Yeah. You don't even have that kind of people in the Surat.
But yeah, it's an amazing experience. I'm going to go every chance I can. It's just super fun.
Who organizes that? Like I always see that, or in the past I've seen that from JR, but is JR organizing, or that's like somebody
so
else and JR just brings a couple of pilots?
Tomohisa, who owns JR, was involved but wasn't running it. This last year when we went over there, it was his first year that he like completely took it over and was running the whole thing. So he was planned all of it with the city, you know, and did all the advertising, all the logistics of putting that event together, and it went really well. So he's actually the one that's running that now.
That's really cool. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good idea of how big RC airplanes are in Japan. I know that a lot of brands come from there, so there has to be some following.
It's pretty massive.
How popular.
Yeah, they have a pretty big base of RC. Anything in, over in Japan is pretty popular, especially flying.
Any fun plans for this year?
Yeah, it's a pretty busy year. I'm doing a full-scale air show in a few months over in Northern California. And I think I'm supposed to fly like this guy's big pits with like a 6-cylinder gas engine, like 50% scale or something. But it's supposed to be pretty cool because I guess we're going to be flying like in between the full scale acts, like right off the main runway. Like,
what air show is this?
It's a Moses Lake.
Okay.
So I have that.
I have to look that up.
I'll be going to like Kings Canyon in April, the jet event over in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
Just some smaller stuff like that. I don't really have anything crazy planned as far as competitions. There is the King of 3D, or I forget what he called it exactly. Over
Crystal
in,
King or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, in Washington in August, I'm going to try to make. And then the shootout in October. So, and I believe they're going to have that air show again in Japan around November. So that's pretty much what
cool.
I have planned.
But it sounds like for the Surat, iMac training is probably going to be starting soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to build an airplane, though. So I got to get going on that. I got to get that Cardan put together.
And that's a Cardan now developed by, or at least distributed by JR, right? Like that's.
Yeah, so he bought it from, he bought Cardan from Dennis and them.
And that's the, like, full balsa construction?
No, so it's fully composite. So the...
Oh.
He, for a long time, he's been wanting to do that. So it just worked out to where he was able to use Andreas over at Carf. And that first shipment that they put out is made by Carf. It looks just like a comp ARF, you know, inside the wings. It's
interesting.
Fully carbon and composite.
So is the general kind of the outer... aerodynamic design is like following more or less the Cardan shape, but it's a composite construction.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, like every time I think Cardan or Dalton, I always think of the typical kit build, balsa, traditional construction. Definitely don't think composite. That's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, and at the last shootout in 2022, one of the Japanese guys that came over, Monto, was flying one of the prototypes. He did pretty good with it. And we had, like, after the competition, we had, like, a group of, like, 20 people up there. And we're just, like, handing the transmitter off, like, all right, you get a couple minutes. All right, feel it out. And we were getting a lot of good feedback on it. It flies really well. So I'm sure you'll see more of those around.
Not very common composite airframes in iMac, though, right?
It is pretty common, yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
Carf?
Yeah, mostly Carf. You'll see some Krills too.
Yeah, I think I've seen Spencer with like a big Carf.
Yeah.
Well, I think this was awesome. Thank you so much for taking time for this. I think, yeah, for people in robotics and especially iMac, there is a lot of good info. Do you have any like final words of advice for people either interested in getting into iMac or people that are doing iMac and just want to keep progressing?
I would say join the Facebook forums. If you don't have anyone out at like your local field and you're kind of interested, like get on the forums. There's a lot of people that are very, very knowledgeable at this that are like super willing to help anyone, and they love to see anyone new get into this. So even if you have a smaller plane, you know, you don't, whatever, they like to see more people get into this. And I think it's good for anyone who maybe is slightly interested just to try it. And if you have someone at your local field that is knowledgeable or is already flying iMac, that's even better because they can help you. It's good to have someone that can watch your flying and kind of critique it, give you some pointers. But definitely, even if it doesn't end up being like you're going and actually flying competitions, just fly the sequence a little bit and read through and understand what the arresti means so you know that you're flying the maneuvers right. But yeah, it's definitely, it would help. And who knows, you might end up enjoying it. And it's, you never know. I would say just to try it for sure.
Is there any particular...
It doesn't really matter what airplane you have either. Like I flew a 100cc through almost unlimited. Like it really doesn't matter. Most planes can fly any of these maneuvers. It's just the level, like once you get to the higher level, the kit builds are a little bit better, but it really doesn't matter that much.
Yeah, until you get to unlimited or so, the limitation is going to be much more on the pilot than on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any particular either forums or Facebook groups that you would recommend people checking out?
So on Facebook, there's like iMac is like kind of separated by all the regions. So they have a forum mm-hmm. for every region. Like I'm in the Southwest, there's a Northeast, you know, South Central. So you could always find those or just join Southwest or message me or, you know, pretty much anyone involved in iMac is willing to help and give pointers and some information. Mm-hmm. They like to see more people get into it. So
cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
With you.
Appreciate it.
All right. See you later.
Take care, man.